Penguin Random House Audio presents One Nation Under Guns, How Gun Culture Distorts Our History and Threatens Our Democracy by Dominic Erdezain. Read for you by Dan Bittner. To my father. But don't you see? This is just the point. What has for centuries raised man above the beast is not the cudgel, but an inward music. The irresistible power of unarmed truth, the powerful attraction of its example. I haven't understood a word. You should write a book about it. Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago. Prologue. You're next. In the first 5 years that I lived in America, four of the five deadliest shootings in the nation's history took place. At a school, a nightclub, a concert, a church. Of the 20 deadliest shootings in the nation's history, 17 have occurred since 1999. And throughout this period, like an athlete shedding clothes, America has been loosening her gun laws, scrapping training requirements, and protecting firearms manufacturers from liability. As an outsider, then as a citizen, my question was the same. Why do Americans tolerate it? Then the matter became personal. I was sitting on a leather couch in a rented apartment when a series of mysterious, abusive, and finally threatening messages came flooding through from an angry acquaintance. First came a picture of a handgun, then bullets, then an image of a man with his head blown off, followed by the words, "You're next." The sender was someone I hadn't seen for months. A woman my wife and I had hired to look after our children for a few hours every week before parting with her on friendly terms. She had been badgering my wife, who is a journalist, about a story she wanted her to cover, and the disagreement had escalated bizarrely. When I stuck my oar in hoping to smooth things over, the fury turned on me. And there I was, swaying under the motion of death threats as my reading matter faded into irrelevance. The words, "You're next," were followed by a series of coded messages about my children being angels, and the sender's father preparing to punish me for 10,000 years. Today I was going to find out how clever I really was. Death for me, a better life for my children. While I was absorbing the shock, I heard a rap on the door. I rolled onto the ground like a shot fox before establishing that it was the UPS man announcing a delivery. Still, I thought it would be a good idea to pick the children up early to avoid any encounters, so I scuttled off to the school in a state of agitation. Housed as we were in temporary accommodation, it seemed the only weakness in my strategy of avoidance would be if she were to find out from the neighbors where we were staying. As I texted them explaining what was going on, the gravity of the situation hit home. Credible or otherwise, a death threat was a crime. Within the flood of outrage and concern, one message stood out. "Hope everything is okay," said my Tennessee-born NRA member friend Michael. "And believe me, if she steps foot in our house, it'll be a huge mistake." I did not reply, but I wasn't as offended by the sentiment as I should have been. I remember something Tim O'Brien wrote about how a crisis catches you cold. You think that by having the right views, you will build up a reservoir of courage that will be ready when you need it. But thoughts are only thoughts. To say that you don't believe in violence means nothing until somebody is trying to hurt you. When I chatted with Michael the following day, he asked me straight, "Do you think you will get a weapon?" A careful choice of words, I thought. He knew my feelings on the subject, and he probably saw me flinch a few months earlier when I spotted his assault rifle hanging on the wall of his basement while he was digging around for a wrench. Would this be a turning point, a teachable moment for an incorrigible liberal? Michael was not what you would call a gun nut. He was an intense, ambitious, energetic guy who never wasted a moment of his life. We bonded over subwoofers, audio streaming, and every kind of technology. We spent many hours sipping Miller Lite on his driveway, plotting the next overhaul of something that was not quite as it should be. Years later, when I started writing articles about guns, Michael gallantly indulged my heresies. When I told him I had wimped out on attending the annual meeting of the NRA Having written a scathing article on the organization for CNN, Michael said the next time he would take me round himself. I loved that. It was not that our friendship transcended our comically divided opinions. It was built on them, a mutual curiosity that an intelligent person could be so very wrong. I was sorry when Michael moved to another city and our conversations about lawn seed and loudspeakers came to an end. But would I get a gun? No. Instead of buying one, I started to think more seriously about guns and why people place their trust in them. Why did every conversation come back to the law-abiding citizen and the importance of not offending him? Who were these people whose rights eclipsed all considerations of public safety? Does the law-abiding citizen even exist? The clinching argument and the catalyst for this book was a series of visits to the Fulton County Superior Court in the aftermath of the text messages. Contrary to my expectation of some sort of private hearing, the whole thing was open, like a town hall in which every member of the audience makes a public submission to the chair. Forced to make more than one visit, we were, by the end, quite conversant with the situations that drive people to seek the protection of the state. These were people living in fear of someone they knew. In one case, the judge adopted a compassionate, almost pastoral tone as she counseled a couple to stay apart, seek help, or face the consequences of the law. These were not law-abiding citizens tormented by a criminal class. They were feuding spouses and estranged lovers, the kind of people who shoot one another every day in the United States. It was, I recall, impossible to determine from the appearance of the assembled parties who would take the stand as the plaintiff and who would be the defendant. The idea that these disputes could have been resolved by a gun struck me as an absurdity. As I began to study the statistics, one thing became clear. Anybody is capable of killing. Most gun fatalities are committed by law-abiding citizens who become criminals only when they pull the trigger. A gun, said Edward Kennedy, is unlike other weapons. It is an instrument of instant and distant death, capable of killing from afar, wounding without contact. Guns make killing as easy as buying groceries, yet America's gun laws seem to exceptionalize it under the belief that most people are responsible and gun violence is rare. Even liberals talked about keeping guns away from dangerous people as though they are perfectly harmless in the right hands. I began to think of gun violence the way William James thought of war. People assume that wars are caused by acts of aggression and failures of diplomacy, he wrote. But the real war is the preparation. The battles are only a sort of public verification of a state of play established in the so-called interval of peace. Self-defense and aggression are two sides of the same coin. In the 1960s, this kind of thinking was widespread and eloquently stated. 6 out of 10 Americans favored a total ban on handguns, and journalists dismantled the pieties of the National Rifle Association with panache. In a gun culture, argued a series of editorials in the Washington Post, there is no such thing as an accident, and the word tragedy starts to become a misnomer. There are only choices. As Martin Luther King Jr. wrote after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, all murders are political in a nation that worships the one who masters the art of shooting and allows arms to be purchased at will and fired at whim. Violence was a plague, not an event, and the plague spread until it claimed the most eminent American. Comparing these statements to the fatalism of the America I had arrived in, a simple question began to form in my mind. When did America make peace with the gun? A series of commissions in the 1960s found that there were 24 million handguns in circulation, recommending that the figure be reduced to 2.4 million within 10 years through rigorous and selective licensing. The policy was backed by more than 3/4 of the population and urged by President Lyndon Johnson as the only solution to the crisis. Instead, Congress refused the request, and the moment passed. Decrying the role of a militant gun lobby that had prevailed over the will of an aroused nation, Johnson expressed his hope that Congress would confront the problem soon. History has disappointed that hope. Instead of Congress catching up with the nation, to a degree that nobody could have imagined, has fallen in line with the gun lobby. In the 50
sample complete. Ready to continue?